The title of this section is Tension and Life Form. Our inability to understand the function of tension stems from a stereotyped idea of nature and life in general. We do not care to look deeply into nature. We prefer to have delightful little games of intercourse with all beings, in our heads, of course. We look upon the fledgling and kitten alike with an artificial sense of motherhood and the wonderment of motherhood. We never bother to explain to ourselves or to seek an explanation of why the kitten grows up and eats the innocent little bird fledgling. We make the mistake of embracing a theological doctrine that everything is placed here as our toys or food. We fall into the role of playing God by virtue of being God's chosen animal. We observe and cause animal misery and cause a tremendous lot of it with a sort of compassionate facetiousness that lets us see only half of the picture, organic life up to the scale of man. Let us take a look at nature in the summertime. The birds are making a noise which we call singing. They were created to sing to us. It is the year of the cicada, and there is a strident, monotonous complaint. They are singing or screaming themselves to death. They have lived for 17 years in the darkness of the soil and are the survivors of an egg crop planted 17 years ago. They have battled from one stage to another to come up from the earth, all in order to live one intense, screaming day of reproduction. A young, helpless bird tumbles desperately from the cradle nest, and within minutes it is eaten by a sleek, beautiful cat. The cat that lurks beneath the tree has kittens to feed. A bird a day or a mouse a day will keep her in milk for the kittens. The robin has her fledglings to feed, two worms a day for her and a worm a day apiece for each of the fledglings. If it is an earthworm that is eaten, that earthworm, in turn, must eat millions of smaller protozoans in order to build the body of another worm. Now we must have a look at the cat. Is she really worth all of this? Sometimes a female cat will bring home a half-grown rabbit for the litter. In the business of equality, it would seem that one cat is worth about 600 mice or sparrows. If the cat lives 2 years, it would take 600 mice to maintain the life of such a cat. It would seem that the purpose of mice is cats. It would seem that the purpose of worms is robins or sparrows, chickens or ground moles. It would seem that the seething ferment of protozoan life in the soil is basically worms or the higher insects that devour them. What is going on in the aquarium of life? There is an incessant churning about of animals and plants trying desperately to keep alive. For what purpose? In each animal and plant there is an evident implant to struggle and to avoid death. We look upon the aquarium of life as a creation. We presume the creation was not haphazard or accidental, that the creation was engineered by an intelligence with a profound motive. At least this is the theological explanation of all that is visible. If this is the case, it behooves us to look for our significance, our place in that plan. For instance, were the planets placed here for our breeding pad, for our pleasure, and for our sustenance, or were we placed here to aid in the evolution of planets? In other words, what right have we to assume that man should endow the planet with such insignificance by making them out to be a mere utility for mankind? Such reasoning might well be applied to viruses and bacteria. And such viruses and bacteria might philosophize that man and animal alike were created to form a culture bed for their lifestyle. Man, the most evolved, is not slain by tigers alone, but by the tiny viruses and worms, bacterium as well. Let us examine the reason for this creation while being aware all the while the fact that it is a relentless scene of carnage. A beautiful, delicate butterfly sails past us, and we marvel at the intricacies of its structure and design. However, this butterfly is lucky if it lives long enough to lay its eggs before being consumed by another animal. We like to think that butterflies and small animals are without consciousness, such as we invents. Yet if we watch them closely, we find that they move in an individualistic, intelligent manner. Each tries to avoid death and injury, and each seems to know how to find dry refuge when the rain begins. And we cannot help but wonder why such a beautiful and highly specialized creature is created to live only a few days. We hear that all of creation is for the glory of God, and we cannot help but ponder the quality that must be rendered from the reduction of millions of beautiful beings into soulless, senseless fertilizer. I say soulless because most theologians infer that small creatures have no souls. Souls are only for more complex and favored anthropoids, whose beautiful bodies likewise are reduced to millions of tons of fertilizer. And when we lose a beautiful child to death, we know that somehow the situation between us and the butterfly differs only in our conceit that we are more important. And we rationalize even our death as being more noble and more special. There are some possible answers to this painful ferment we call life or creation. One is, of course, that the whole thing is an accident. That would rule out the need for a chief engineer. Another explanation would be that protoplasm tends toward inertia and that it must suffer continual irritation in order to be prodded into trying to extend its life, to avoid death, and generally improve a self-conscious dynamism. This explanation has some value. Mankind makes its greatest technological progress, it would seem, in the painful, bloody welter of war. The individual, in order to advance his individual abilities, must submit to the disciplines and pressures needed in education. However, man seems to advance much more quickly than the rest of the animal kingdom, and this may result from the artificialness, meaning non-naturalness of the war implant, war stimulant, and educational stimulants. Man does not eat to kill when he kills his own species, and seldom does he allow the bodies of victims to fertilize the earth or to be used as food for other species. And in the realm of education, man's early education, diaper training, begins man on a course that is not destined to fertilize the earth or to stimulate the aquarium with bacterial agitation. He is constantly trying to thwart the previous balance of nature. He dumps sewage into the rivers from which he drinks, jealously denying it to the surface of the soil where it might do some good. He is developing vestigial organs from domestic living, which he labels progress. His sex life bears a frequency witnessed in no other animal except possibly the male goat or ram. There is no doubt that man is stimulating himself or is being stimulated, but there is no evidence to show all of this evident stimulation has moved his interior dynamic nature to affect his genetic structure so that he will be less of a robot and more of a self-conscious dynamic creature. We come to the conclusion, therefore, upon looking at centuries of human absurdities and the centuries of struggle in the animal kingdom that lifts the animals upward not one visible fraction, that evolution is not the reason for all this suffering, at least not evolution alone. The clam cannot get out of his shell after being there perhaps for a million years. There is another explanation for the carnage and irritation. It is known as natural selection. The weaker ones are killed in order to guarantee that the species will go stronger or at least hold its own in the aquarium. However, this does not hold true in either the human kingdom or the animal kingdom. Man kills off able-bodied in war and leaves the breeding to the inadequate. Animals, on the other hand, are apt to perish in wholesale lots when they become too strong and numerous, when the fox is able to catch every rodent and bird, it starves to death. When the lemming is able to capture every blade of grass, it starves to death. Each, the carnivore and the herbivore, is no better than its food. So that if the grass becomes eliminated by blight, and if all plant life became eliminated by blight, then undoubtedly it would not be long until all of the animal kingdom would perish. Likewise, if all the rodents committed suicide, it might be fatal to their chief enemy, the fox. At this point, I wonder what the chief engineer would be doing while the rabbits were committing suicide. Quite a gap might develop in the balance of things. With this in mind, we might consider that man might not be allowed to exterminate himself in an atomic war unless a fatal ignition had been planned for eons to trigger the transformation of our planet into a sun. There is still another explanation for the battle of life. This would be the transmutation of energy from coarse to more subtle beings. This would imply that the lower forms of life, and this might include men, have actually no purpose except to develop food for higher and higher life forms. The immediate question would pop up as to identity of the highest life form, which might be the recipient of all this waste and profit. We have the grass supporting the cow. The grass cannot continue to grow in the same place unless it is periodically fertilized, as it will exhaust the life of the soil. So that from this simple relationship, a whole ferment of life is explainable. The cow is eaten by the lion, the tiger, or the human, and most of the cow's dung and body is returned to the soil. In the jungle, the lion is not killed for food, but like the fox, is directly dependent on disease or starvation to limit his numbers. The plant eats non-organic foods. It is, in turn, organic food for higher organic bodies. The amoeba eats bacteria of very simple form. The amoeba is eaten by a metazoan of very simple form. The metazoan is eaten by a little larger metazoan. And so on up until a form of life is developed that is digestible by humans and other carnivorous predators. And yet all the while that man is profiting from this weary chain of parasitism, he is being attacked and destroyed by some virus or infection of protozoa or metazoa of microscopic nature. The virus is preparing man for his death and his return to the process that gave him life. Something is evident in all of this chain of parasitism. On the ascending scale of parasitism, the use of smaller or less complex organisms for food, almost all, if not all, parasites, are superior to that to which they eat, and they in turn produce a still higher, more subtle form of energy that was possessed by the beings ingested. We would not consider trying to digest the exoshells of beetles, exoskeletal shells of beetles, but the chicken does not hesitate. In fact, the chicken has specialist grinding apparatus to take care of hard objects. On the other hand, we do not hesitate to eat the chicken or the chicken's eggs. The cat eats the chicken, but we do not eat the cat. Animals seem to follow the same rules, so we cannot blame this choice on the Bible, directions only to eat cloven-hoofed animals and so on. The dog does not eat the cat even if he kills it. The dog will not eat the flesh of a snake, wolf, or predator whose diet is meat alone. The animals seem to sense that the flesh of these predators is not subtle or delicate enough to attract the appetite. Paracelsus claimed that the predators had fiery mumia, or flesh essence. Vegetarians indicate that eating the flesh of animals makes humans more like the predators, while other foods are inclined to develop man into a more benevolent creature. In this business of the transmutation of energy through living food, let us look at this thing called personality. It is evident that besides the destruction of complex and beautifully designed bodies, we also witness the destruction of personality. If you have ever lived on a farm and viewed the animal life there with less than total detachment, you could not have avoided noticing the lack of regard for personality. It is evident that animals have personality. They do not seem to have, but that is because we only watch them as objects, not as beings. They are capable of irritation, anger, jealousy, and affection. And what is still more, they are all self-conscious to the point that they are aware of danger to their body and life. Some observers think that animals know nothing about death, but such observers have never witnessed the mourning of cattle when one of their numbers has been killed. I have seen animals in the slaughterhouse take peculiar steps to avoid death. One small slaughterhouse killed the cattle by shooting them with a small caliber rifle. On several occasions, older bulls would go to the farthest corner away from the man with the gun and steadfastly hold their head in the corner so not even a side shot could be effective. We know, for instance, that mice have personality when we pen them up and become acquainted with them as pets. Kittens and cats have personality. A calf likewise has a personality, and we are aware of this if we watch a cow closely that is fresh. A language is used by the cow that is emotional, and the calf responds to it. It would be easier to witness this endless carnage if personality were not involved. We even try to adjust our theology to soothe our conscience in our desperate search for protein. Yet simultaneously with the theological excuse that animals are soulless, comes another theological exhortation to avoid eating meat, at least on Fridays. We know that we would not eat our friends or even our pet dogs because we are aware of their personality. There are people who practice cannibalism, but we do not find that their ingestion of superior food renders them superior to other men. In fact, groups who practice cannibalism are looked upon as being less equal culturally to other people. I bring this up because the evidence scale of value of food and parasitism, which might seem to make the cannibal the top parasite and might seem to endow the cannibal with being the chief purpose for all animal and plant life. Why is it necessary for the food of the cat to have such dynamic self-consciousness and personality? Why could not the mouse be a stupid creature, unaware of its danger and unaware of life's importance? Why does the chicken or duck that we eat have the unique nature and dynamism for life? We see the law of progression and effect with the upward scale of parasitism. By the law of progression is here meant that any series of events or circumstances that indicate consistent direction also indicate a possible continuance of that direction beyond the series presently witnessable. In other words, if it be possible to fly 2,000 feet, it is conceivably possible to fly 2,001 feet. The law of progression insinuates that we are possibly the victims of parasites. Yet we see nothing eating our bodies. We carefully embalm the bodies so that nothing will eat them, and we bury them in protective concrete. So if there is a parasitical entity using mankind, it must be invisible to us. At first glance, this may seem like going to great lengths to demonstrate that a likelihood or a possibility should be viewed as a reality. However, let us look at the possibility with some intuition. We deplore the depths of our children and even our old people. Death is a terrible finality as far as personality is concerned. When we look upon the corpse of our loved one, we are dumbstruck with the fact that it is upon us. We are dumbstruck with the fact that is upon us, namely, that the personality which we knew will never again be known to us. We can rationalize resurrection, but all the evidence point to imminent decay of body and brain and personality cannot be the same even if it were possible to detach itself from them in some spiritual form of life. Our computer cries out to us that our loved one has died forever, as far as we really know. This means, too, that we shall die. And in dying, the somatic personality shall leave the scene with the same finality. Now let us suppose that each creature has a soul or is a soul. We can accept this and still have no explanation for the carnage in the aquarium of life unless that carnage fits into the scheme of things as being some sort of meaningful factor in relation to the soul. We hear of the theory of spiritual evolution through reincarnation. And this theory has the hope-instilling promise that the soul somehow grows in size, importance, or some sort of quantum by virtue of ascending through an educational series of lives, which lives consist mostly of suffering as a result of the person or animal's inability to choose the right conduct. The whole process indicates an important creator or engineer. An omnipotent creator would make things perfect to begin with. We cannot, looking at this scene from the human viewpoint with the human notions of justice, see the wisdom in the centuries or eons of endless torture for all life forms. In the law of progression, we are dealing with a series, in this case with an evolutionary series. We can look both ways at that series. And looking backward, even with an eye for justice by human or animal standards, we can see the same degree of personality. We cannot see the same degree of personality in microscopic bacteria, nor can we see meaningfulness in the concept that each virus has a soul. That must either be a virus soul forever or suffer through billions of years to evolve into a personality and body that will be more specialized and dynamic. So that in looking back over the series in question, we can see if we are more evolved than chickens, and if chickens are more evolved than worms, then by reversed progression or retrogression, we can see that a virus may have little or no individuality or specialization. It is my opinion that there are a limited number of explanations for this suffering, and the four named would probably take in most of them. However, these explanations are only explanations offered by this mundane relative mind. We must always realize that a view from the direct mind or absolute mind will give us another explanation. Such an explanation might be that the creation, carnage, and conceptualization of suffering are all simple or complex dramatizations by the mind projected upon some screen for the experience of the projector. Since we have not reached the ability to view the creation with such an absolute mind, the only sensible alternative is to view and speak from the mundane mind. If all of this world is a dream or drama, there must be a moral to the story, a theme at least. I propose that we examine the parasitical system, unembellished by wishful thinking. That which we see is animals eating animals. We are an animal eating plants and animals. There is a chance that some animal is eating us, or some entity. We cannot see the virus that causes cancer or the common cold, yet we admit that such exists. We cannot see an incubus, succubus, and we deny that they exist. If the purpose of mankind is to produce energy for other beings, which may not be visible to us, then that energy would need to be subtle because we are not visibly attacked and eaten. This theory of the existence of energy entity parasites does not automatically bring with it the need to accept these entities as being of superior essence. They would no doubt be strategically superior, but then so would a mosquito or a flea, if either were able to tap our veins, drink, and get away without our knowing it. This theory that man has a subtle energy and that it is subject to parasitical attack is not new. When the woman who was afflicted with an issue of blood touched the hem of the garment of Christ, she tapped his energy quantum, and the drain was so noticeable that he felt it. Most healing is done with this energy quantum. Whether it is done by a single healer or by a battery of believers, The miracles of Christ were exertions of quantum energy. Individual genius is directly related to the ability by that individual to know and store and properly use that quantum energy. Likewise with spiritual progress. Spiritual progress depends upon that transmuted energy. In other words, man eats food and produces energy. The energy has a quantum and possibly has a quality and difference of types, some energy being usable only in certain limited directions or applications. Evidence of the parasitical use of this energy is indicated in many branches of esoteric philosophy and religion. The priesthood of many religions stingily guards their energy with celibacy. Rites have evolved to exorcise the entities that would drain the energy of traumatic victims. Experiments were conducted to find chemicals that might dispel some entities, such as asafoetida. The finer energy manifests itself in some instances as ectoplasm, and this substance is manifestly used by entities to weave portraits of people shells so that the medium will produce more energy, and we can only surmise that the entity in question does not work for nothing. This still does not give us a clear picture of that which is happening behind the scenes, nor do we have a clear idea of our relationship to the whole process. One important unanswered question deals with our importance as a personality. The question has to do with the relationship of personality survival to essence survival. In other words, it looks as though we cannot expect to depend too much on personality survival. Most religions and movements teach or infer that the personality does survive death. However, this belief is small comfort when we stand beside the casket of a loved one and hear the message from the depths of our computer telling us that we have definitely seen the last of our friend. Personality is in itself a transient thing when we study it. The personality of the child is not the same of that of the aged adult. When a child dies, we do not remember it as a mature personality, but as an immature child. This has led some spiritualists to make the claim that a child matures after death and develops a mature personality. If this is true, we would still never again see the same child's personality which we knew at the time of its death. Since personality is a changing thing, it cannot be looked upon as being the person. If a person is not a single, unique personality, then we can only presume that if he has a uniqueness, it must be his essence, which is unique, individual, and unchanging. If a man is a series of different people or personalities, he then could expect his immortality to be a memory of that series, or he might expect indefinite change beyond the death state, in which case his relatives might not recognize him if they saw him. We find that personality is changed by things which happen to the person, and more remarkably still, it is changed by persons with whom contact is made. Again, we come to the possibility of energy transfer. It has been said that couples who are married for many years sometimes grow to resemble one another. It is known that if we love a person, we are inclined to adopt their way of thinking. And when we adopt a way of thinking, our whole being changes. And this includes the body, even though the process is slow. Nearly everyone who has any hope for immortality has also a hope, which he would like to call a faith, that man's individual personality will be eternally unchanged. There is no logical reason for this to be the case. However, it seems man, the constant victim of change, conjures visions of a state of no change. If the child of 10 could encounter himself at the age of 70, he would probably view the old man as being a stranger. Some religions try to wrap together a dogma of personality permanence with this evident transience of the original stages of personality. As mentioned earlier, the spiritualists claim that the person who dies as a child finishes his growth on the other side. This may be their dogma, but one outstanding case of materialization would imply that such is not always the case. Harry Price, who spent much of his life investigating spiritualistic phenomena, lists one materialization as probably the only one that he considered to be authentic. He saw in 1937 a materialization of a little girl who had died at the age of 6, no later than 1924. Yet 13 years later, she appeared fully visible and touchable. Price could pick up her pulse and heartbeat. She was still a 6-year-old child, about 3 feet 7 inches tall. This brings us to another side of the coin. Many spiritualists at this point will tell us this little girl may have been the creation of an entity. It is evident that in studying spiritualistic phenomena, we must take into account that some materializations are phosphorescent cheesecloth, some are manipulations of questionable spirits on the other side, and yet some may be real. It just seems that no matter how you view all evidence that might corroborate personality immortality, we still come up with parts of that evidence that contradict or nullify anything that might point to a definite hope for personality survival. Many people dream of the dead and find comfort or conviction that the deceased are really communicating with them. However, the visions in the dream may well be manipulations of entities in a mental dimension, or they may be the incarnated results of our own anguish. Many of such dreams of a particular relative show the person as having a different personality in different dreams. All of this may be understood better if we find that the personality is little more than a mask and find the real self in both the vision of the deceased and the viewer. Let us examine now the strange methods by which human energy is siphoned off. The most outstanding and seemingly useless one from our point of view is the massive bloodletting in wartime. We see a different pattern of energy taking upon the comparison of the energy lost by animals and humans in death and in sexual outlets. The animal is generally killed for food. There are no wholesale slaughterings of animals for the sake of warfare between animals. Likewise, the sexual habits or outlets of animals are generally timed for reproduction only. The animal breeds in the breeding season. Man breeds at all times. In the last war, World War II, we can estimate that around 40 million people were slain. This is not an exact figure, and I am not concerned with exact statistics, but the Russians alone lost between 14 and 20 million. Germany and Italy admitted 8 million casualties. England lost 1.25 million men, and France and Japan each lost at least 1 million men. It is absurd to believe that all these men died without that dying somehow being accepted or caused by the engineer in charge of this project. We find that some wars are sparked by events more than planned by humans. No one concerned wanted to do more than bluff. We find that all wars are caused by factors so complex that not even the combined intentions of any government could cause or stop a war. Individuals like Hitler may be credited with creating an atmosphere wherein their constituents were galvanized into a war spirit, but even Hitler is at most merely a tool for the zeitgeist. No individual can predict or cause a war unless the time is ripe. we can safely presume that in primitive or aboriginal cultures there was little war. This can be seen by studying primitive peoples. The Australian Aborigines, the rainforest peoples of the Philippines, the Eskimos, and most of the tribes of Africa seem to care little for war. In New Guinea, some headhunters kill each other, but it is presumed this is done to find some escape from the bananas and vegetable diet. As man progressed and became more scientifically advanced, we noticed that his wars almost became rhythmical. From the earliest days of history, history bears mostly a record of bloodshed caused by man killing man. In the last century and up until World War II, this rhythm showed about a 20-year cycle just for this country alone. We had wars in 1898, 1917, 1941, with the cycle growing quicker with the Korean and Vietnam Wars. This regularity and increase in regularity may have some meaning. We notice that there have been few wars among the primitive people, and for the more advanced countries, there were many more wars among highly specialized nations and less among the second-rate powers who might have more reason to fight. Mexico, for instance, has not been involved in a war since their revolution, and that was a limited local war. Some reason backwards and state that nations who fight are those who are highly developed along technological and scientific lines. It may be that those who have the most highly evolved minds and bodies are the most in demand. We noticed that this slaughter of men in war does not come under the same law as the slaughter for natural selection, as was noted before. War is manifestly a harvest of prime flesh, not a culling of unfit individuals in the herd. I can only presume that the motivation for war is prompted by those entities that profit from bloodshed and has little or nothing to do with the motives and ambitions of tribes or nations. I presume this even as I presume that the motivation or temptation that leads to a sexual excess is likewise motivated or caused by the entity that profits by the experience and has nothing much to do with the individual. Man's pleasure, his ego, and his sexual drive are all implanted. As with any habit, we will notice that a nation that wars will not grow stronger, but will consistently be weakened down by the excess and will be replaced as the world power or dominant nation. The entity or force that prompts the nation or individual to excess must profit by the prompting in some manner. If we estimate that entities do not just do things for no reason at all. If battlefield blood is the equivalent of food for an entity or class of entities, then we can presume that the entities will grow stronger being fed and grow weaker if denied that food. And the opposite seems to be more apparent for the individual who manages to deny himself and the entities involved sexual excesses, meaning celibacy or conservation, denies the entity and rewards the person. What has this to do with good and evil? Are these entities superior to us and beyond resistance on our part, or are they simply acting to the best of their ability in their dimensions, seeking out sustenance as an ordinary animal might with no notice at all toward that which he or it eats? We have reviewed the upward growth of life forms, noting that each evolution may be good in that inert matter may develop expression so that life itself may eternally spring from that which is either dead or inert to the point where it seems to be dead. If man's destiny is rooted in that upward growth, then the whole weary eon-lasting stage of metamorphosis may seem worth the while for us. But in that planned or unplanned evolution, there seems to be no divine signature or parallel upward growth of spirituality. We become more complex, and with the complexity of body and mind and technological fruits of those complexities, we seem to be less and less oriented toward or programmed for the solution of man's spiritual problems. By spirituality or spiritual problems is here meant the recognition by the individual that infinite individual survival may be possible. Spirituality is recognized only as the result of a crisis, some grand crisis resulting from eons of lesser crises. All upward growth is the result of crisis. And it is for this reason that national technology is stimulated by the crisis of war to produce a new advanced technology of war that is later carried over in some useful form after the war. The crisis in an individual, which may be caused by a collision with another willful human being, may result in the post-crisis development of that individual into being a superior adversary in the long run. There are many stories or biographies of men who have endured physical oppression for periods of time, after which they rose to be giants, both mentally and physically. The story of Samson is an account of a double crisis. Samson's concern for his fellow countrymen developed a crisis in him and caused him to focus all of his physical energy toward the accomplishment of freeing his people. His story is similar to the Kung Fu and Karate origins, where an oppressed people summoned their energy, focused it, and found a way of deliverance. The story of Samson is sometimes interpreted as being a parable, a subtle allusion to the ability of determined men to raise their kundalini, to develop enormous physical immunity and insight by rechanneling their sexual energy. So that it may be symbolically put, when the account reads that when he, Samson, encountered the woman, he lost his sight and his strength. The double crisis resulted from his memory of the first crisis and of his knowledge that he could create another crisis if he wished. John of the Cross became enlightened possibly as the result of a crisis. The crisis, death of Christ, caused the veil of the temple to be split and caused the sky to darken for 3 hours, according to Mark and Luke. On a lesser scale, we find the pages of history filled with the feats of diverse Galahads who conquered real or technological dragons by the summoning of total energy. Because his heart was pure to overcome the seemingly impossible.